Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. Welcome back to the podcast. It's almost Halloween. What's your favorite candy, Ernest?
I have to say I like Kit Kat.
Yeah.
But my kids like it the most too, so can't really steal it from them anymore.
I like all types of candy. I'm not picky whatsoever. The market has been delivering some tricks and some treats to investors. We'll get into that. We also are going to get into a number of our companies reported earnings, of course, and we'll talk about some big tech names. And our feature discussion will be, why in the world do we invest in stocks in the first place? What does it all mean? What are we trying to achieve? And why do we think stocks are the best place for investors who have a long-term mindset? Sound good?
Sounds good.
Let's get into that. Before we get into that, let's get into this. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to it on YouTube, on Apple, on Spotify. And please check out baskinwealth.com. Lots of great videos, podcasts, blogs. You'll learn a little bit about our investing style and how we operate. And of course, if you want to talk to us, you have needs for a portfolio review, you want to get a second opinion on what's going on, or want to learn more about how we invest, please reach out to us, give us a call. You can find us on the web, you can find us on Twitter, you can find us on the mobile, you can even knock on our door. So with that, Ernest, it's been a weird finish to October. Markets rocking and rolling. Gold at one point was up a lot, came off. The big tech names all reporting earnings this week. This is the last week of October, of course. We've had a number of companies report strong earnings. Sometimes their stocks went up. Sometimes their stocks didn't go up as much as we thought they should. And sometimes our companies who reported great earnings and raised guidance, their stocks fell a lot. So we urge all of our clients and investors, you can't learn very much from the volatility that happens after earnings. Some of it can be, just based upon different types of algorithmic trading, things that people may say in the conference call, things that they may not deliver guidance in the short term. We try to avoid the short term thinking that doesn't help us in the way we invest. Ideally, we're looking for companies who have the long-term mindset and are focused on growing their business. They may take their short-term lumps, but we don't care. I was talking to you, Ernest, on Teams the other day about how many stocks in our portfolio have more than doubled, and every single one, a client has asked us to sell it at a lower price for whatever reason, or we got nervous here at a lower price. That's just investing, right? You can't get scared out of a company because the stock price goes up too much, and you can't get scared out of a company because the stock price falls too much. Focus on the fundamentals. Do your best to have conviction in what the long-term growth is going to be. And we like to stick with our companies. We understand sometimes that they can do frustrating things. I guess we'll get into that with Meta, for example. But, a lot of these people who are running these companies got these companies into incredible valuations, incredible market capitalizations, still running the companies even though they don't need to do it. And they have the long-term vision. And all we want to do is latch on to great managers, great allocators who have that long-term mindset and know how to create value over a multi-year period.
Right. And especially on the point about looking for managements that are investing for the long term. I think this is increasingly in short supply today, both among companies as well as investors who like to say we're long-term investors and we want companies to invest for the long term. Yeah. But then you see them complain when the stock hasn't performed for 2 or 3 months, and then they said, well, what have you done for me lately?
Yeah. So let's say we have a stock, it reports earnings, we thought it's pretty good, and the stock falls 10%. Of course we feel it. Of course we feel bad that the stock has fallen a lot. I own all the stocks that the clients own, so I'm feeling it in my portfolio as well. But I'm not going to let a drop in the stock price in a 1 or 2 day period tell me what to do next. nor am I going to, obviously I'm drooling over some stocks and things that we don't own that have gone up a tremendous amount, but I'm not going to lose my mind. I'm not going to chase performance and give up, things that we know are going to work well, fundamentally speaking, and hopefully the market will accommodate to the fundamentals over the long term. So we can't react to short-term earnings. We're not even going to play that game. We're not even going to let it bother us. I've been doing this, Ernest, for 25 years. That's how many quarters a year? Four?
Although if Trump gets his way, apparently two soon.
Yeah, so like that's 100 plus earnings seasons where I've seen craziness. Sure, there's been a lot of volatility along this one. Some of it, it's harder to explain, right? We've seen some companies go up on announcements where they're signing deals with AI and go up 25% in one day. But I think those things aside, nothing has really changed with how investing is, in our opinion, and how it will be going forward.
Right. And I think a lot of it has to do at the end of the day on really doing the research and understanding both the company that you own in, that it's a high quality business that's doing the right things, as well as a management team that, again, knows what it's doing and is going to be able to make the necessary changes to their business, like mm-hmm. with Google, as we talked about not that long ago, where they're able to adapt their business to whatever is happening in the AI space going forward. And so I think that's what gives you the conviction to be able to hold a stock if it, falls in the short term, maybe even more than 10%, but gives you more conviction to buy more and hold over time.
And so generally speaking, our approach to our portfolio is, if a stock goes down a lot and there's no real fundamental news to justify it, you can imagine, and you probably know, that we're buying more of it.
Yep.
And we're happy to add more. We're always happy. I'm happy to buy more of stocks that have gone up, where the fundamentals don't reflect what we think is going to happen in the future. And I'm happy to buy stocks that have gone down a lot if the stock has been hurt too much, right? Sometimes stocks will go down because the fundamentals are in trouble in the short period of time. And that's fair. We have to decide whether we want to stick around or find something better. So in this market, of course, Ernest, you've seen just tremendous moves in some speculative companies this year. I think you had a chart about companies that are doing well, and most of them are what, non-profitable techs?
Yeah, so the chart was from Schroders,
yeah,
the investment firm. Mm-hmm. And basically it said that the best performing sector this year is NASDAQ listed companies that have no revenues.
Give a couple ideas.
So quantum.
Quantum computing.
Quantum computing related stocks.
This company called Oklo that makes nuclear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These are companies that don't have a product, right? They not to say that they're frauds, but
yeah,
then they literally do not have customers today. They're selling that they created a new technology, or they're trying to build something that's exciting, innovative.
Yeah,
but they're zero revenue companies today, mm-hmm. and the market is very excited today about these kinds of companies.
Yeah, so there
and,
could,
and,
yeah,
and then
yeah,
the flip side,
please, yeah,
the worst performing sector subsector is profitable companies. So on the one hand, you have companies that don't make any money, actually don't have any revenues, doing really well. And on while companies that are making money are doing terribly,
yeah,
and stock price wise. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of
either their stocks are underperforming.
Yes.
The other we'll call them factors, or their stock prices are actually down year to date.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe it kind of makes sense if you think about the current interest rate environment that we're in, with mm-hmm. falling interest rates and a lot of retail-driven trading of stocks. But if you are sticking to high-quality businesses, it's definitely been a frustrating period of time.
For sure. And it's reminiscent of 2022, when we owned a lot of good companies and the quality ones seem to be hurt the most for some reason. And of course, if you study history, it's very reminiscent of the dot-com, what happened in 2000. Now, history doesn't necessarily, you can't learn from one period to the next because there's so much context, but clearly nothing changes when it comes to fear and greed.
Right.
Right. And so what we're talking about specifically is if you look in 2000, underperforming names were the stalwarts. Procter & Gamble, that was what, like, still an amazing business, but that was one of the largest companies in the world at the time. Berkshire Hathaway, you can name all these non-tech companies, and their stocks were either down a lot, or completely underperformed what we would call those pre-revenue type companies in the dot-com, the pets.com, and all these other crazy stuff that went haywire.
Including some real ones.
Including some real ones. I look at a chart today, it's like, if this is a bubble that we're in, it's certainly not in profitable companies, even the big techs, maybe Tesla. But even NVIDIA's trading at somewhere in the 30 times earnings ranges, and the other big techs are trading in the 20 or 30 times earnings. But many of them are expected to grow top and bottom lines by double digits for a long period of time. So if they're bubbly at 20 or 30 times earnings, then maybe I should quit investing, because I don't understand what a bubble is if it's those valuations.
And I think we'll get into this a little more when we're talking about Meta and Microsoft and Google's earnings.
Yeah.
But it really does seem to me that on the one hand, you can be skeptical about the ongoing losses that seem to be happening at OpenAI and, mm-hmm. and ChatGPT and the long-term business model of some of these model providers. But the fact remains, for at least for the big techs, even NVIDIA, they're making a lot of money funding this this AI, whatever it is you want to call it.
Yeah.
They're making money selling computing power to these companies, and
not just making money, making an incredible amount of money.
Right. And yeah. And so if there is somebody willing to, if you're running a company and somebody is willing to give you money, I think you just have to stand up and take it. Right?
If there's free money, for sure. So, what is our mindset? How do we operate in a period where good quality is being disregarded and people are throwing money at pie in the sky ideas? We're not going to play along. We've been through this so many times, and I can show our viewers so many examples of speculative movements in different factors and companies that didn't make money, that they didn't justify. I wish I had bought them at the beginning and rolled them at the tip to the tippy top and got rid of them, but it's not how we invest. It's not something we know how to do. We rely on valuation. We rely on fundamentals as our guide. We rely on quality of management and capital allocation, some quantitative things. How do you rely on that when you're talking about speculative, non-profitable companies? What's your anchor? And even if you were lucky enough to buy one of these stocks, you bought it when it was unprofitable. It's gone up, 200%. It's still unprofitable. Well, what do you do? Would you have held it all that way? It's not logical to think that someone would have done that.
Yeah, and I think the good news for being profitable is that if you're profitable, you make money. And that you can, if you're making money, then you have money to do things with. Yeah. You can invest in your company, you can buy back stock, which is something that a lot of our companies are doing today. Yes. And there is a margin of safety there, which a pre-revenue company, even to the extent that they have a very bright future, just doesn't have.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not wishing doom and gloom. I'm not wishing for a correction or a market pullback. I'm not wishing for anything, but I know ultimately that the market will come to its rational senses,
right,
and start rewarding companies that are growing their profits over the long term, reinvesting smartly. We are in the age of AI disruption. Impossible to know what the future is going to bring. But what we're seeing right now is, an ungodly amount of spending and companies saying that they're seeing value in using these AI programs. So we're going to talk earnings about some of the big techs that reported. We want to get into it and see how, what those three companies are saying, Meta, Microsoft, and Google, all reported last night. And before we get into
And by the time this podcast is out, I'm sure Apple and Amazon will have also reported.
For sure.
And hopefully the Blue Jays will have won the World Series.
Oh, yeah. We didn't talk about the World Series. So in 1992, my parents took me and my sister to the final game where the Blue Jays won the World Series. Joe Carter hit the home run. My dad was jumping up and down like a crazy person. He couldn't sit still. I remember leaving this, I think it was called the Sky Dome at the time. Yep. Now they call it the Rogers Center, leaving it. And my dad trying to protect the family because there was, crazy. Everybody was so happy and excited. And there was the crowd was so, could have gone really risky for us who were little at the time. But nothing better than baseball. I feel like we have a full-time job, not only watching baseball, but also investing. So
right.
I need a little break. Hopefully the Blue Jays can finish it off. Are your kids interested in watching the Blue Jays?
They are.
Yeah.
But I think some of the games are getting a bit late at night.
Yes.
Even for myself, where I think it was game three where it went to 18 innings. And I didn't stay up for the entire game.
No, neither did my. I think my wife stayed up to the 17th inning. Then she went to bed. And of course, inning later, the Blue Jays lost. No, I like to get to bed. I can always figure out what happens tomorrow morning. So before we get into the big tech earnings, just quickly on some of our financial services companies that reported earnings, TMX Group, as well as MSCI.
And Moody's.
And Moody's, right? So these are three financial service providers. They sell data, they sell proprietary software, they sell information to all different types of financial services institutions. These are three companies that we've held for, MSCI is relatively recent, but terrific compounders, smart capital allocation. All three really reported what I thought was excellent numbers in the third quarter. And I think many of them either raised their guidance or said, the future looks pretty good. And so why are those financial services companies reporting such strong results? What's justifying it?
So I think in general, financial data-related companies have had a weak year overall, because some of the other providers in this space have been reporting fairly weak results. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of created an overhang on the whole sector in terms of investors wondering if it will spill over to these other companies as well. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that all three of these companies, MSCI, TMX,
Moody's,
they all three have undergone a fairly similar journey over the last, let's say, 5, 6, 7 years, mm-hmm. where they used to have a core business that was profitable. And so in MSCI's case, they sold indices to asset managers, mm-hmm. like mutual fund managers. Mm-hmm. TMX Group had a listings business that they
owned. Toronto Stock Exchange, Toronto Venture, the Venture Exchange, Montreal Exchange. Yeah.
They had a listings business where companies that are on the TSX have to pay fees. Mm-hmm. And then Moody's has the ratings business, where they provide bond ratings to companies that need to raise debt.
Yeah.
And so all of these had a core business, which is it's a good business, a high margin, like asset light, recurring revenue type business. Mm-hmm. But they diversified out of that core into other more attractive growing areas, partly to reduce the volatility of the businesses that they were in. So in MSCI's case, the mutual fund industry, to no one's surprise, is kind of in a declining state.
Yes.
Right. So they went out and they diversified their client base. They went into they started selling licenses or their indexes to indices to hedge funds, to broker dealers, for ETF end markets.
So while mutual fund growth is declining, there's other things picking up the slack,
exactly.
Right? Hedge funds, ETFs, privates.
Yep. They're going into the wealth management space. So really trying to, they tried to do ESG and sustainability, and that's, hit a bit of a roadblock.
ESG, the bloom has come off the rose a little bit on ESG. It's still, very important for a lot of, financial institutions, but less exciting.
Yes. But they've been fairly successful in kind of diversifying the customer base, mm-hmm. in that business. Mm-hmm. For TMX Group, they've had a very clear focus on diversifying the business out of the exchange business in Canada to international data related stuff. Mm-hmm. So they have Trayport, which is kind of a software solution to trade gas in Europe. Mm-hmm. That's a very high margin, high growth, recurring revenue business. And then they also bought Vetafi, which is the index providing business, again, similar to MSCI, a high margin business. That
a lot of mutual funds are converting to exchange traded funds.
Yes.
As well as people are taking advantage of all these new thematic investing, whether it's quantum computing or AI or AI infrastructure. And so you take advantage of that by launching an exchange traded fund that can play that specific theme. And you got to buy the data from TMX. And TMX sells like a template for you to build that, right?
Yeah.
Pretty exciting.
And so the benefit of that is that they, TMX, no doubt about it, really benefited this year from the strong markets because the markets are volatile. So people want to hedge using derivatives. And so they're trading like things like futures and options more. Mm-hmm. And then because...
And those are high margin things.
Yes.
Right? They don't make a lot of money when you trade a stock, but they make a lot of money when you trade options and future contracts and those kind of things. Yeah.
And then there's a lot of... Because the markets are good and... Especially, there's a lot of very speculative type trading out there. Their equity trading and their listings business is really benefiting as well.
Nice.
So, but I think TMX understands and everyone understands that, you know, good times come to an end. And so that's why they've tried to diversify the business into these more resilient streams of revenue, such as Trayport, and with the goal that even in bad times, you know, the company's still going to grow pretty well. Mm-hmm. So they've done a great job in doing that. And I think that will help protect the business going forward.
So, okay. So MSCI looks to be launching new products.
Yep.
That's their goal. TMX Group, the goal is to continue to diversify away from the listings and trading business, correct?
That's right.
Yeah. So there's more acquisitions to come.
They recently made another acquisition. I think they bought some nuclear, a portfolio of nuclear related indices.
Okay. That
they can launch ETFs with.
Yeah.
And so again, they also bought another research management system that they could use to sell TSX data to firms like Baskin Wealth.
Okay.
Right. So really just going along the same path of trying to make the business less sensitive to kind of the swings of the market. Mm-hmm.
And just to finish off, the CEO of MSCI, Henry Fernandez.
Yes.
Pretty interesting guy.
Yes.
He views his stock, the MSCI stock is undervalued.
Yep.
Although it does trade at a lofty valuation, it's an amazing business and generates high returns on incremental capital. And he's put his money where his mouth is, and he spent over $20 million of his own money buying shares of MSCI over the last 18 months. That's, you only buy stocks for one reason, and that's to make money.
No, further to that point is that there's certain companies where their buyback activity is usually a good signal that the management thinks things are going to get better. Mm-hmm. MSCI is one of them, where they're very careful about trying to time their share buybacks to specific points when the stock price is low. Mm-hmm. They have if you kind of plot their share buybacks against their stock price chart, they have a pretty good track record of being able to time the bottoms of their stock. Very nice. And so they did a very large buyback this quarter. The CEO himself is buying stock. And so I think
it did its largest buyback in history in one quarter.
And so these don't have anything to do with the fundamentals of MSCI, but certainly shows the management is confident about the future of the company.
Very cool. So big tech, we had gigantic, first of all, let me just say this. The revenue growth from some of these companies who are $1 trillion market valuations, it's just, let's think about it on an absolute basis. Absolutely insane. Meta, I know the stock is down 10% after earnings. However, the company reported revenue growth in the quarter of 26%. Grew its revenue year over year from $42 billion to $50 billion. Added $8 billion of new revenue.
In a quarter.
In a quarter.
Yeah.
So like that's unbelievable. This is not a small cap company.
Right.
This is a company that is approaching $200 billion of revenue run rate and growing at scale, accelerating the top line. Google, a few quarters ago, was reporting top line growth of 10 or 11 or 13%. This quarter, I think it was 15 or 16%. Microsoft, I didn't look at the numbers yet on Microsoft, but you get the story, the demand. And where is this growth coming from? Well, for Google and Microsoft, it's coming from the demand for cloud services. And for Meta, it's clearly their spend on AI, which is insane, is leading to proof that it's working in the revenues. So let's get into all three of those amazing businesses that are just continue to defy the law of large numbers.
Right. And I think the main story here, kind of disregarding the stock price movements after earnings, is that these companies have such large user bases that they are able to reap the benefits of AI just by implementing it into their products.
So let's be specific. Meta has 3.5 billion, is it daily active users or
monthly?
Monthly, yeah. Active users.
So it's like half the world.
Half the world.
Yes.
Half the world is logging on to Instagram or Facebook or WhatsApp.
And keep in mind, they don't operate in China.
Yeah.
They don't, which has a billion people.
Okay.
Right?
So they know everything about you. There's no better business in the world. And what's happening with Meta is their goal is to make you click on more ads and buy stuff. And is it working?
Yeah. So at this quarter, the financial performance was very, very good. They basically said that the investments in AI that they're doing is leading to people being more addicted to Facebook and Instagram.
What was the number that I sent to you? Double-digit growth in the U.S. Time spent on Instagram?
So 5% time spent on Facebook and 10% increase in Threads.
Yeah.
I don't remember if they gave out an Instagram figure, but probably similarly impressive.
And now it's Reels business is a $50 billion run rate revenue business.
Reels is a
This is a complete copy that they copied TikTok.
Yes.
And from zero to a $50 billion run rate business growing at scale at a tremendous rate.
Right. And I think the most interesting part was that because due to the way that Meta's auctions work, there's usually an inverse relationship between the number of ads that are being shown and the price per ad. So the more ads are being shown, the price usually falls and vice versa.
Yeah.
This quarter, both went up. So impressions grew and pricing grew.
People are spending more time looking at the apps. People are
viewing more ads.
Looking at more ads, clicking through and actually spending money. And what's the problem? Why in the world will the stock be down 10% on such fantastic news?
Right. And they're seeing very tangible results on their investments in AI from things such as improving the relevancy of the ads that you're being shown. So knowing that I'm a Blue Jays bandwagoner and that I have two children and therefore I might be more interested in buying a youth-sized Blue Jays hat versus showing me a Blue Jays sweat, like costume for my dog, which I don't have.
You don't have a dog, right? So it would be a waste of time to show you.
Yes.
Yeah.
So being able to do these is driving more people to click ads. Mm-hmm. And in a very tangible way for Meta. It's not a hypothetical like AI one day kind of thing.
Flywheel is accelerating for
so,
Meta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then I think the thing that is the market was worried about is that they included a comment in the earnings that 2026 CapEx.
Capital expenditures. What it's going to spend on building out data centers and all the other stuff it needs to grow its business.
It's going to be more than the increase from 2025 to 2024. So just to put some numbers to that. In 24, they spent $39 billion. Mm-hmm. And this year, they're going to spend $71 billion. Mm-hmm. So $32 billion increase.
Yeah.
And so next year, that means they're going to spend over $100 billion on data centers. And so I think there were a lot of, naturally, the investment community, like, you know, we're financial people, like we like numbers.
Yeah.
And so there were a lot of questions, like, what's the return on this type of, on this money that you're spending? Do you have any kind of measurable statistics or milestones that you're looking for to know that you're on the right track?
Right? And those are fair questions.
Yeah. And you know, I think Meta was a little bit, Mark Zuckerberg was a little bit coy. He said, like, you know, we want to make sure that we have enough computing and that we can do everything that we want to try to do.
Well, that's also a publicly traded company. They're not going to reveal all their secrets to the world on a conference call. They're always going to be coy. Follow the thing, the new products and services that they launch. Listen less to the vague word salad that they say.
Yes.
Yeah.
And especially the fact that so much of what a lot of the extra computing power that they're investing in is going to their superintelligence labs division, which is essentially a research lab that is not making products, right? And so I think that's what the market is worried about, especially because of the fact that just 4 years ago, Mark Zuckerberg and Meta went on a very large, very expensive project to develop the metaverse, even renaming the company to to reflect that.
Yeah.
And it ended up not really, you know, really becoming anything.
And let's recall what happened to the stock at that time. The stock was trading in the $300 range.
Yep.
It fell to 90 bucks.
Yeah.
Right? So anything can happen. All Meta did, and Meta was dealing with other issues at that time.
Yes, yes.
Apple was trying to thwart its ability to track advertisements, right?
Yep. And there was some overhang from COVID.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so but had you ridden or kept confidence with Zuck, you would have doubled your money within 3 years. Even if you watch it go from 300 to 90 back to $600 or $700 a share. So in some sense, you have to respect Zuck and trust in his abilities. I'm sure he's got an overarching theme of what he wants to achieve. But in the meantime, the fundamentals of the core business have never been better.
Yeah, and I thought it was really interesting how he framed the investment that they're going to make. Mm-hmm. Is that under one scenario, let's say the research that we're doing ends up leading us to make the AI god, right? Like we achieve super intelligence. And then obviously there are like a lot of good things that can come out of that. So your return under that scenario is very high. If it doesn't turn out that way, what they're as we already talked about, they're able to use that computing power within their core business, and they're seeing no shortage in number of applications that they can use.
Everybody says they're capacity constrained; they don't have enough compute power to run their models, to run their learning language model, to do the infra. I mean, it's, and we're still at the beginning, so I think people are overreacting to a short term, albeit crazy, insane CapEx number. But, I'd rather them spend the money up front today than spend it over a number of years if it means that they're in a race to win, right? And so these are the things that Meta thinks is the right allocation of the capital. Let's move on quickly to Microsoft and Google.
Sure.
Microsoft, it's just another puck in the net type quarter. So Azure revenues, which is a cloud business, I think accelerated to 39%.
40. Yeah.
40. Okay. Yeah. I think they guided for next quarter for, And so the stock is down about 3%, but keep in mind it ran up a few days ago when it announced that it owns a good chunk of OpenAI, and OpenAI is looking to go public at a $1 trillion valuation. And so I think that reflected in the stock price the previous day. So it just kind of given it back. It was an amazing quarter for Microsoft, right? Anything unlike Meta, where there was a surprise on the capital expenditures and the higher spending on salaries and all that spending, Microsoft is knocking it out of the park, right?
Right. So they are seeing good results in, again, rolling out Copilot, which is their AI solution, adding it to things like Excel and PowerPoint and Microsoft Word, and upselling those to corporate subscribers. Mm-hmm. And So that's we
use it here.
Yep.
You can laugh at it and you'd say, I will never use it, but we have many people in our office helping them with a number of different spreadsheets and processes and say it's terrific.
Yep. And similar to Meta and similar to Google, they said that they're capacity constrained. Mm-hmm. So they are investing in data center CapEx, but not on a speculative basis. This is money that where the revenues are fully committed.
So what capacity constraint means in other words is that we would have sold more stuff had we had the ability to build it. Yeah. had we had more NVIDIA products and more racks and more data centers. The demand was there, we just couldn't meet it in the short term.
No, I think as a one thing that I will, I think there was a hint by both Microsoft and Meta mm-hmm. that they want to be a little bit careful about how they are investing in CapEx going forward. So with Meta, they signed a deal with a private equity firm mm-hmm. where they would essentially lease the data centers off this private equity firm to, you know, be a little bit more nimble about how they're building things going forward.
So instead of coming up with the capital itself, they're gonna a lease.
Yeah. And then with Microsoft, what you saw was that they essentially, Oracle came in, they offered to build these data centers for OpenAI at fairly low margins. And Microsoft basically, even though they had the right to first build the capacity for OpenAI, they went and said, look, we're not going to do it at these type of economics. We think it's too risky. We're going to let Oracle do it. And so we are seeing some hints of discipline mm-hmm. That are coming out of these big techs. All right.
So we feel very good about Google, of course. You know, this was a stock where everybody hated many yeah. months ago. I think the stock is now doubled. It's approaching $300 a share. It's become a large position at our firm. We've held it, I think, Ernest, since 2013, 2014. When we bought it, we liked it because of the Google search.
Yeah,
the Google search business is still doing incredible.
Yep, and they're seeing good results from
yeah.
AI.
Yeah,
they launched AI Overviews. They are using AI to create new ad products for advertisers, mm-hmm. similar to Meta. They're using it to benefit YouTube. And so here's an anecdote, which is that I think my son is currently doing a research project at school. And, you know, like in the old days when we did research back when we were in school, mm-hmm. they told us not to use Wikipedia as a source.
Okay.
Do you remember that?
No, because you're a lot younger than me. I didn't have the internet when I was a kid.
Okay.
Okay, yeah.
But basically,
Internet didn't exist until I was probably first or second year university. Okay.
We were not allowed to use Wikipedia yeah. as a source.
Yeah.
But now my son, he's doing his research project and all the research he's doing is just coming out of AI Overviews,
yeah.
which I don't know if it's correct or not. I said, maybe you might want to check in a different source yeah. to see if what you're researching is real.
Trust but verify, yeah.
Yeah. But people are using it and it's becoming a big thing for Google.
Yeah. I used to have to go to the library to do research. That was before your time when we actually looked at books. Okay, so
no,
that's...
But, yeah, no, but yeah. I think the key for Google is that AI is helping them protect their moat. Mm-hmm. In contrast to kind of the disruptive narrative that we had, you know, just a few months ago, now it's very clear that people are using AI to use Google's products more.
I mean, you look at how much free cash flow Google generated, and it's grown its capital expenditures yeah. too, yet it's still generating an enormous amount of excess cash flow. And it's been buying back stock,
yep.
it pays dividend, maybe more acquisitions. I mean, Google, it just shows you how tremendous its core business is.
Yeah, and just maybe one last comment mm-hmm. on all three of these companies.
Please.
Is that their margins were good.
Yeah.
And the reason this is important is because they've spent so much on data centers over the last year and are going to increasingly more going forward, the fact that they were able to grow revenues at the same pace as the depreciation charge that they have on these data centers basically means that they're generating good returns mm-hmm. on the money that they're spending. And so, you know, we'll we'll see how this goes next year as the depreciation headwind ramps up even more. But so far, so good.
Yeah, well, so we'll get that's very helpful. So our feature discussion today is why we invest in stocks. Last week, our feature discussion was why we're sticking with compounders, even though people seem to only want to buy speculative, non-profitable growth. You know, we've talked on this podcast a number of times about our strategy, how we invest, what is comfortable for us. We thought, I mean, this is not like a firm that we've started a year ago. We've been in business for well over 25 years. And we've really stuck to, you know, three types of investments for our clients: publicly traded equities, publicly traded bonds, and cash-like products.
Yeah.
You know, I see so many prospective investors. I talk to investors and clients who have investments with other advisors, other managers. And I'm not here to say that those managers are doing a good job or a bad job. It's, you know, everybody has a different way of doing things. But it's very unique. I don't see many wealth management firms doing what we're doing, which is just being plain vanilla, not allocating money to third parties, not putting our clients into products that have performance fees and other fees, you know, and we pride ourselves on keeping our fees low for our clients, on transparency. Sometimes it resonates with people, sometimes it doesn't. But what we really want to get across to you today on the podcast is why we like stocks. Like, why does it resonate with us? And Ernest, you wrote down a few notes, so I'll let you kick it off.
I think stocks have gotten a bit of a bad rap, where people today kind of view them essentially as gambling instruments that you have, you know, no control over how they move. Mm-hmm. You're essentially just gambling when you buy a stock.
Well, to interject, I mean, everybody in the market is playing it. I mean, the stocks are a tool.
Yes.
Right. And you can achieve results based on your time horizon, however you like.
Yeah.
You can gamble and trade stocks, or you can say I'm an owner of a business like Warren Buffett, and I'm going to let the management do what it's got to do, and I'll want make money that way as a long-term investor.
Right. Yeah. But I think if you go down to the kind of the base of it, a stock is an equity owner and is an ownership stake in a company, right? When we own a share, when we buy a stock on, like, let's say Apple stock, we are owning shares of a real company, like a real company that is making products. You know, they make iPhones, they're employing people, they're generating profits, they earn, pay dividends, and all those kinds of things, right? It's not like playing blackjack where you're kind of just, you know, flipping cards or rolling dice on an outcome. These are real companies that are doing real things.
And what are we betting on over the long term? What are we achieving when we're buying a stock?
What you're betting is that it's a good company and that hopefully over time they'll continue to do good things and that they're going to make more money, and which will be reflected in the stock price. And so I think a lot of people often forget that the liquidity aspect, which is basically the price movements that you see, I think they get distracted by that, right? They forget what they own is a real company, and they start looking at the movements to determine how much money they're making, which is not an entirely incorrect thing to say. But
well, we have too much information at our hands today and too much data, right? And so anybody can log on their phone, on the computer, and see their portfolio value in real time, second by second, see what's working, see what's not working. Naturally, your mind, you have a good day, you feel good. Oh, I'm so smart. Or that Ernest, what a great investor. He made me so much money. Bad day. Oh my God, should I call Ernest and tell him to sell all my stocks? Meta's reports earnings, stocks down. Oh my God, what am I missing? Am I stupid? Should I call Ernest and tell him to sell it? Yeah. I mean, these are the things that everybody goes through.
But I think people forget that the liquidity that you have, the ability to actually buy and sell stocks, like there's no downside to it versus a private investment, right? Like the ability that you can, you know, today just click a button and sell into the market is a very attractive thing. Now, you can, if you contrast that with private investments where there is no market for it, sure, like it doesn't look like your portfolio is moving on a daily basis, but you actually can't sell the product.
Yes.
Right? You can't just go out and convert that into money immediately.
When you have hard times, you have a gigantic need for cash flow, whatever it is, or you get nervous about a certain sector or industry. If you own something which is not liquid, you're stuck.
Yep.
And you may be stuck for an extremely long time versus if you own Apple and you get scared that Apple's going to be disrupted by A, B, or C, you can sell it.
Right.
Yeah. And the risk is you either sold it at a good price or a bad price. I mean, either you're dumb or smart, but at least you can get access to your capital.
Yeah, right. And even I think going further than that is that the companies themselves have benefits from being
liquid
and public as well, mm-hmm. because it's a tool that they can use to help their business. If the stock price is high, then they can use that as a source of capital. Not all companies do this, but they're able to
sell more shares,
issue stock.
Yeah.
They're able to use it to go out and make acquisitions, maybe give it to employees and hire more talent. Mm. And these are attractive features of having a high stock price. Yes. Whereas if the stock price is low, then if you're a profitable company, you can buy back your stock and create value that way. Mm. So there are all these levers that companies that are public have that a private company just doesn't have available to its disposal.
Very good point. So liquidity is number one.
Yeah.
We always talk about here, everybody's so afraid about volatility in the stock markets that they need a product that doesn't move.
Yep.
But what happens is the best companies in the world, 99% of them are publicly traded.
Right.
There's no Apple that's private. Right? There may be Mars chocolate bar is a private.
Lego group.
IKEA is IKEA. Yeah. So there's two or three.
ChatGPT.
ChatGPT doesn't make any money yet. But the bottom line is you got all these businesses, Tesla, Apple, Amazon, Google, Nvidia.
Like your speculative quantum stock.
Yeah, you've got the best businesses in the world that are publicly traded. Don't be scared of them. You've got access to them, right?
And I think more importantly is don't get attracted to private companies just because they're private, right? Like you see this a lot where you have investors where they want to participate in these so-called sexy, hot growth companies like SpaceX maybe even ChatGPT or OpenAI, where they want to be able to participate in these private companies when there are all these fabulous, profitable companies you can buy on the public side.
That you know about, that you can easily research, that you can get access to the quarterly numbers and the historical numbers. Whereas in the private, completely opaque.
Yep.
And you also have no idea about the strength of the balance sheets of private companies.
Yes.
A lot of them are levered. A lot of them have been acquired using other people's money.
Yep.
And a lot of them have management fees and performance fees attached to them for hitting certain hurdle rates.
Yep.
This is not the case with Apple.
Yep.
Yeah. And some of them, there's when you buy private investments, sometimes you have to come up with what's called a cash call.
Yes.
Right? You've committed to investing $100,000. They took 50 and they call you up a week later and say, well, we need the other 50. And you said, holy smokes, I forgot about that. I don't have the 50,000.
Right.
Well, they'll say, well, then your original investment is canceled and you're not getting your money back. If I don't ever want to buy more shares of Apple, I don't have to. There's no one forcing me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think there are really not many downsides to investing in public companies. Mm-hmm. Now, whether you do that through an ETF or whether you pick individual stocks, I think that's up to you.
Yeah.
But I think there are, from our perspective, we'd rather just buy the best companies that exist that you can buy easily.
So just to go over the benefits of owning publicly traded stocks, you have the liquidity, you have the ability to access some of the most amazing businesses in the world. These companies have value creation tools to use to improve their to allocate capital smartly using the stock price. You have a lot more transparency.
Yes.
And you have the ability to compound your money in a very tax effective way owning most shares.
Right. Right. So I think long story short, like stocks are awesome.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of the benefits of being listed and being a public company and having your stock listed, I think a lot of companies, and especially if like the management is not necessarily aligned with shareholders, they can use that to their own advantage, mm-hmm. and to the detriment of their shareholders as well. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I mean, there's we're obviously excited about the way we invest, but there's always going to be bad actors. There's
right.
going to be fraudulent behavior whenever money is involved. And big money, you yep. know that there's going to be bad actors involved doing nefarious things. And this can happen to anyone, even owning a great company. Bad stuff can happen. That's why you diversify. That's why you don't put all your eggs in one basket. You don't put all your money into one company, even if it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. You have to use the rules that we've learned in corporate finance to protect your portfolio. And that's the most important thing. So with that, we really appreciate all the feedback and the listenership. Our podcast is growing. Jump on the train. I hope you enjoy it so much. And we'll see you back here real soon. This podcast is for informational purposes only. And any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.